and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
This law will be enforced, and it will allow
us to know. The Illinois Secretary of State's office says it's seeing, quote, ridiculously long lines as Chicagoans rush to get their real ID. Federal funding for Head Start could be on the chopping block. Illinois families are pushing back.
I want more babies in the United States of America.
And the Trump administration is pushing for a baby boom. And now to some of today's top stories. Congresswoman Robin Kelly becomes the next candidate in the race to replace outgoing U.S. Senator Dick Durbin.
I'm Robin Kelly. You could say I've been an underdog my whole life. Growing up at my family's mom and pop grocery store, it was early mornings and long days. I put myself through college in Peoria, worked at the hospital where my kids were born, and at a child abuse prevention center as a counselor and mental health professional.
In her announcement video, Kelly says she's running on a platform of public safety and gun legislation, as well as lowering costs for families and tackling health inequities. She currently represents Illinois' 2nd Congressional District in Congress, spanning from the Kenwood community on the south side to I-74 and Danville, Illinois. For more on who's considering a run for Senate, check out our website. Governor J.B. Pritzker announces he will testify before a congressional committee about Illinois' protections for undocumented immigrants. Pritzker will appear before the U.S. House Oversight Committee alongside Minnesota Governor and former vice presidential candidate Tim Walz and New York Governor Kathy Hochul. Pritzker's appearance is likely to represent a flashpoint in Illinois' ongoing battle with the Trump administration, which is attempting to strip sanctuary cities of all federal funding. The hearing is set for June 12th and will come 3 months after Mayor Brandon Johnson testified in front of the same committee. If you're taking the Kennedy out of the city this month, you might need to find a new way to get on or off the expressway. The Illinois Department of Transportation is implementing ramp closures for about a week at a time on the outbound Kennedy until the end of May. The closures will impact ramps at Ogden Avenue, Division Street, Ohio Street, and Keeler Avenue, with that one lasting 2 weeks. IDOT officials say the ramp closures are needed to complete repairs and pavement patching as part of a 3-year rehab project on the Kennedy between the Edens Junction and Ohio Street. More ramp closures are expected later. The Harlem Globetrotters are getting a historic recognition. The legendary basketball team is receiving an honorary street sign called Globetrotters Way, which will be located at the corner of Pershing Road and Giles Avenue near Wendell Phillips High School, where the team got its start. Known for blending their captivating basketball skills with comedy and theatrics, the Globetrotters also played a pivotal role in breaking racial barriers, eventually leading to the integrated NBA. Up next, what you should know about the Real ID as TSA begins enforcement measures tomorrow. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
It's a day 20 years in the making. Starting tomorrow, travelers catching a domestic flight will be required to present a Real ID or another federally approved identification. That supposed deadline has set off a rush for some travelers to the DMV, but not everyone needs one right away. Our reporter, Eunice Alpasan, is here to break it down for us. And Eunice, remind us, what is the deal with Real IDs and why now?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, Brandis, this has been 20 years in the making, and the Real ID Act was passed in 2005, and after several delays, the federal enforcement period is finally upon us. A Real ID meets the security requirements mandated in that federal law, which the Congress passed in the aftermath of 9/11. And Illinois residents can tell if they have a Real ID by having a gold star in the upper right-hand corner of their driver's license or state ID.
And so what if you still don't have one?
So luckily, if you're trying to catch a flight, TSA says they will accept other forms of identification. They have a full list on their website, but that includes things like a passport, a permanent resident card, or a military ID, for example. But if you still don't have any of those, here's U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem during a House oversight hearing earlier today.
What will happen tomorrow is folks will come through the line and will be issue their ID and show it. If it's not compliant, they may be diverted to a different line, have an extra step, but people will be allowed to fly.
Yeah, so you might still be able to fly without a real ID for now, but you should get to the airport early in case you are faced with additional screening.
And there's been some long lines, though, at the DMVs lately, right?
Yeah, so ridiculously long lines, to quote Illinois Secretary of State Alexi Janulius. Those long lines of people actually prompted Janulius to hold a news briefing to remind residents that they can still get a real ID after May 7th. And it's also worth reminding that a real ID is not required to drive or for proof of citizenship.
Okay, good to know. Eunice Alpasan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for information on the documents that you will need to get your real ID, be sure to check out Eunice's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. Among the list of programs at risk under President Donald Trump's so-called skinny budget proposal is Head Start. Parents who otherwise may not be able to afford childcare rely on Head Start when they go to work or school. The program operates across all 50 states and supports more than 600 childcare centers and 28,000 children across Illinois. Completely shutting down the program requires congressional approval, but Head Start advocates say the disruption and uncertainty are already having devastating consequences. Joining us now on the potential impact of cuts are Lori Frichtel, the executive director of the Illinois Head Start Association, and Mikeyla Collins, a former Head Start parent who now sits on the board of directors at the Illinois Head Start Association. Thanks to you both for joining us. Lori, start with you, please. Remind us how Head Start is funded and how that funding works to serve children.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity to share and talk about Head Start tonight. Head Start is funded federal to local, so the funds come from the federal government to the local program. We have over 50 what we call Head Start grantees across the state, and thousands of centers that provide and support Head Start services. Head Start programs submit annually an application or grant application, and their level of funding is set within the grant application. And then they pull down federal funds from what's the federal payment management system as they need those funds throughout that annual year of services.
And how does that work? How does all that work to support children and families?
Right, so the funding is there to support the services for the Head Start program. And majority of the funds go to pay the workforce. And so we've experienced difficulty over the last few months with funding, pulling down funds and accessing funds to keep programs open and providing those critical lifelines for our families and the services for children, which parents depend on to get to work. They need a safe, reliable source of care for their child.
And Mikeyla Collins, tell me more about that and how Head Start was useful for you when you were, your children are bigger now, but
yes,
when you needed it.
I actually was able to work full time because I didn't have to get my children at, you know, an early time because the program stayed open a little longer. I also was able to, I had issues with food deserts at times, and they were able to provide services. My children were just able to get what they need. And me as a mom, I was able to get assistance with getting the CCAP program going on. And
CCAP, the Child Care Assistance Program through the state of Illinois.
Yes, and it was just very helpful. Then I was able to volunteer at the center and always be around my children if I needed to be.
I'm sure that was helpful as a mom. You can keep an eye on them. Lori, you just mentioned this, but even before the federal government decides on the status quo or the status, excuse me, of this programming and funding, President Trump's executive orders were already impacting Head Start. Tell me more about that.
Correct. So there's been a lot of executive orders. And the two that I would like to highlight is one around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the other around immigration. And so we are part of the ACLU lawsuit for primary reasons around the dismantling regards to the funding, which we talked about, and also because of the diversity, equity, and inclusion. The rules came down that we were to remove diversity, equity, inclusion from our work, from all of our websites, and all of the, when you write a grant application, you include good work that goes into programming for young children and families. And at the heart and soul of that is diversity, equity, and inclusion. And to remove all of that is not right. It's mean-spirited and wrong. And so we think that program said they'd just remove the language and keep providing the services like they always have, but now we have to certify that we're not doing anything related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and also spending any funds around that.
Which is directly in conflict with the state's requirement.
Correct, yes. So many of our programs blend and braid funding. They weave it together with Preschool for All or Child Care Assistance Program, and the state, the policies and regulations are grounded and founded in diversity, equity, and inclusion.
While we're on it, remind us of the history of Head Start.
Yeah, we started 60 years ago during the racial tensions, and it was because of Head Start that the funds go federal to local, because states didn't want to help families in poverty, and so the LBJ administration said, let's do federal to local. And so that's our founding principle, was we were born out of the racial tensions and provide a great service within all of our communities across the state.
And today in Illinois, 41% of the children that you all serve identify as Black, 36% identify as Hispanic, 14% have disabilities, 4% are in foster care, and 8% are experiencing homelessness. Without the ability to plan, Makila, what does that mean for organizations that aren't sure if this funding will exist in some time?
I think it scares us all. It scares families. It scares organizations. We don't know if we're going to wake up tomorrow and Head Start will be gone and they don't have anywhere to take their children every day, and folks will be out of a job. So it's really scary. Organizations are scared to even step up and say anything. They're scared to write about it, talk about it, send people out to, you know, riot about it or whatever. You know, it's really hard to just know that the services that I received and my children received could no longer be there for other families in need.
And what would that mean for parents, right? It's one thing for providers, but it's another thing for parents to have this uncertainty as well.
If I did not have Head Start, I would not have been able to go to work full-time like I did. So it would mean that a lot of parents may be out of work. A lot of parents may have to work part-time. And some parents may not even be able to go to school. I was able to work, go to school, and just do what I needed to do for my family.
Lori, what are you hearing from your member providers right now?
Oh, that they are worried about their funding, the chaos, the uncertainty across the board. And this impacts our already fragile workforce. And, you know, so that they're worried about attracting and retaining staff to work in our programs, because of the chaoticness of the administration.
So you mentioned the lawsuit that the ACLU has filed that you all are a part of. What are you seeking here?
So bottom line is to protect our Head Start, early Head Start programs across the state, protect the funding that Congress has already appropriated. We feel like it's being slow walked to dismantling the system, the closure of the regional offices that were 50% of the federal staff are gone, and how are they going to manage the workload to support our grants and our contracts across the state. And then the whole piece in the lawsuit regarding diversity, equity, and inclusion, and supporting the lifeline that Head Start provides for our children and families across the state.
What is the likelihood, or how concerned are you about the damage being done by the time a lawsuit is adjudicated?
Well, we're really worried about that, but we think we're in good hands with the ACLU and the support from all of our state partners, from the governor, from state agencies. We think that together we will push things forward and provide support that's needed.
And before we go, Mykayla, your kids are bigger now. They are
yes.
8 and 17.
Yes.
How are they today?
I think my children are wonderful. My daughter attends the number one school in the city and state, Walter Payton. She's a junior. And my son is accelerating really, really well, where his school adapted the accelerated program for him to be able to be in a third grade classroom. So he's a second grader, but he's in the third grade classroom. So I like to thank Head Start, because without Head Start, I would not have had that push as a parent to make sure that my children were learning the way that they need to learn.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. Best of luck as this all gets figured out. Lori Frixel and Mykayla Collins, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a look at the country's birth rate as the Trump administration is looking to persuade more women to have babies. President Donald Trump is pushing for a baby boom. His administration is considering possible incentives for future mothers, including a $5,000 postpartum baby bonus, government-funded programs to educate women on their menstrual cycles, and a National Medal of Motherhood to moms with six or more children. While some are backing the president's baby boom push, others think the baby fever frenzy is part of the rise of pronatalism, or the belief that a declining birth rate is a threat to the future of society. Joining us via Zoom is Peggy Heffington, University of Chicago history professor and author of the book, Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother. Professor Peggy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I think you might be on mute. But while you're unmuting, I'll ask this next question. Do you think these incentives, are these enough to make people want to have children or more children?
Can you hear me now?
I cannot hear her now,
okay.
But does everybody else hear her? Seems like we're having maybe a technical issue. But if while I've got you, like, what are these incentives? I mean, are they, do you think they're enough to make people want to have children or more children?
I mean, it's my perspective that these proposals are really mismatched from the complex reasons why people aren't having kids. Take, for example, the medal for mothers with six or more children. Society already does reward women in sort of superficial ways for having children, but it doesn't back that up with the real material support that they need. Things like parental leave, postpartum support, the programs that your previous guests were talking about, like Head Start, that allow parents to work full time while also having their kids, and then you know the baby bonus amount of $5,000. I mean, it doesn't even come close to offsetting the cost of having children. Just to take one example. In 2022, the Kaiser Family Foundation found that the average cost of an in-hospital birth out of pocket for someone with employer health insurance was almost $3,000. So that $5,000 is going to get eaten up just in the cost of birth alone. So I think that these policies are not only insufficient, but they're kind of mismatched with the real needs of parents.
What would you say might incentivize people to have more babies?
It's a great question, and it's a really complicated question because, of course, you know, I mentioned things that would really support parents, like parental leave, like postpartum support, like childcare subsidies. And there are countries that have all of those. Like if we look to some European countries, to France and Scandinavian countries, they have all of those supportive policies and more. And yet their fertility rates are roughly the same as ours here in the United States. I think, you know, it's within a tenth of ours. So I think the right question is not necessarily how do we get people to have more children. I don't know that there's policies that have really proven to be effective at moving the needle. I think a far better question to be asking is how do we support parents? How do we make the act of parenting a happier and easier endeavor? And we know answers to those questions, and they aren't medals.
Well, you know, on the subject of medals, I have to be honest. I did a little bit of research before this segment, and medals of motherhood are actually something that that was given before in Germany to encourage women to have German babies when the Nazi Party was on the rise. But this modern day movement in America, are there parts of this movement that are skewing majority white, traditional heterosexual family?
I mean, I think explicitly or implicitly, those themes are there. Concerns about, just for example, the administration's policies seem to be centered on a fear of the future American population dropping. That's why they need us to have more children. But at the same time, the administration is actively working to prevent young people who want to come to this country and raise families here from entering, or deporting people who are already here with their families. And so I think that shows us that this isn't just about sort of future population numbers, it's about what kind of people will be in the United States in the future. And there's a long history of this. If we look back to the late 19th century, the early 20th century, people were also concerned about population. But at the time, the American population was booming thanks to immigration. So what they were really concerned about was the fact that white women were having fewer children. And I think, you know, the similar concerns about the future racial and ethnic composition of the country are sort of at play today as well.
That said, as you said, birth rates are down. And according to the CDC, the number of U.S. births from 2022 to 2023 went down 2%. And the average number of births declined 2% from 2015 to 2020. Vice President J.D. Vance has called the declining birth rate an existential threat to civilization. I mean, if we're to set the politics aside, is a declining birth rate something to actually be concerned about?
I think economists would say yes. I would just emphasize that you know, the U.S. is in a really unique position versus other low-fertility countries where, you know, compared to countries in East Asia, for example, that have very low fertility rates. The United States has a very eager population of young people who want to come to the country to live here, to work here, to raise families here. So while declining populations may be a problem in the future for various places in the world, that does not have to be our problem. It doesn't have to be only fertility that solves that.
There's another phenomenon that we're seeing gaining momentum on social media, and that's the rise of the trad wife or traditional wife on social media content, thinking about like Ballerina Farm and Nara Smith. Influencers who, you know, are getting famous basically off of, you know, their content about child rearing and cooking and being, you know, that sort of traditional wife structure. Is that popularity sort of a rise of the, or a sign of the rise in popularity for conservative values?
I mean, I think so to a certain extent. From a conservative perspective, these influencers are selling a return to a past where, you know, men were manly enough to be breadwinners and women just got to, you know, stay home in their feminine domestic spaces and, you know, live their best lives raising children and taking care of their home. Of course, these influencers are making that look a lot easier and more beautiful than it was probably experienced by a lot of women in the past. And that's largely because of money that is invisible in these stories, that's rarely mentioned. That these are, you know, Ballerina Farm is sort of funded by family money on her husband's side. But I do think that there's an appeal of these. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, sorry, I was just going to say we're out of time, but I do want to hear what you have to say. We'll just have to do it next time we have this conversation. Peggy Heffington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that is our show for this Tuesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. A new effort to reduce Chicago's massive affordable housing shortfall faces a crucial test at tomorrow's city council meeting. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.